Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Your shopping is done. You're home by the fire wrapping presents, right? Or will you be one of those people out there in the madness tomorrow and the next day, body-slamming housewives and befuddled dads who are just now starting their preps for the holiday? If so, you have my sympathies, because I'll be right there alongside of you. Tonight we have two compelling stories told by two credible, respectable professionals in their chosen fields. They don't know each other, as far as I know, didn't work for the same organization or employers, and there are differences in their accounts of what happened to them up close and personal, their encounters with something very strange. But there are many striking similarities, too, how it affected their lives in dramatic ways, and the continuing turmoil they and their families have experienced long after the main encounters were in their rearview mirrors. And because both of their stories need some breathing room to fully understand it, we're going to get right to it. In the second half tonight, a guest who's been recommended to me by several colleagues, his name is Terry Loveless, who was forced to confront what turns out to be a lifetime of profoundly disturbing experiences, as personal as they get. Encounters with some other intelligence, and I mean a lot of them, and their machines. Terry had one of his encounters, one of the main ones, while serving in the U.S. Air Force. But his experiences, he learned, started much earlier and have haunted him for decades afterward. And he's now in a position where he can tell the story. Incident at Devil's Den is the name of his tale, as told in a recent book. This will grab you and not let go. But first, we're going to hear from a former NASA astronomer, a scientist who is typically dismissive of unknown craft flying around the sky or aliens or UFOs, any of those topics in general. He kind of towed the line, the scientific line, that there's nothing to it, nothing to any of it, until he didn't, until he saw it for himself. And there was a price to pay for that as well. Photographing the encounters, and I say encounters plural, he's been spied upon, sabotaged, followed, threatened, you name it. I was in contact through a third party before Marian Rudnick ever came forward to tell his story, and I'm glad we're going to finally have the chance to hear the whole thing. Marian joins me momentarily. Our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, and I have culled together items and oddities from around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories this week, you know, in light of the holiday season, a coast-type angle on Christmas, terrifying figures associated with this holiday. Santa, it turns out, has mythological company and not merely Krampus. We have two speculative science pieces asking semi-rhetorical questions, one about whether traveling backward in time is doable or not, and the other asking if it's actually a good idea to make plans to colonize space, to move humans out there into the great beyond. Maybe not. We have a golden oldie salvaged from the files of NIDS. That's the organization we discussed on last night's program, the private science group here in Las Vegas back in the 90s that was studying UFOs and consciousness long before ATIP or OSAP or TTSA. Danny Silva dug up some old NIDS public files and about their mission and the scope of the operation. It's interesting reading, and I'd forgotten some of this stuff myself. Also, a Nick Redfern story about surveillance operations aimed at UFO researchers and groups. We've heard these stories. We've even seen some documents that have been squeezed out of the government over the years through the Freedom of Information Act to suggest that UFO researchers, investigators, and organizations are under surveillance by various entities, and Nick has written a new story about that. Those and a few other stories in Knapp's News tonight, and while you're there on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day if you subscribe for a year. You can listen any time of the day or night, as often as you want, on just about any device. Gives you access to a vast archive of programs, including the Art Bell Collection, the classics, and you can also subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, A lot of compelling programming there, similar to what we cover here. With that, let's get right to it. Assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the marmot. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those worn flannel jammies and your toes into some floppy socks. Plop yourself down someplace comfy. Turn down the light and turn up the radio. In a moment, former NASA scientist Marion Rudnick, his showdown with shadowy agents intersect. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Those of you who tuned in to last night's program might remember this. We had about 23 hours ago, in fact, we had a conversation with a caller who asked, why don't astronomers see UFOs? And the short answer is astronomers do see UFOs. I seem to remember the scientist who discovered Pluto saw UFOs and spoke publicly about it. Tonight, we'll meet another who's done the same. The story begins with a sort of a warning that we're going to get into in a moment. But my guest is author, astronomer, artist Marion Rudnick. He's worked at icy mountaintop observatories, discovered asteroids, named a bunch of them. He's hunted asteroids for NASA, mapped lava flows on Mars. He's worked on NASA missions to Venus and Neptune. And he also transitioned into working for Hollywood studios, including Disney, doing animation and visual effects on movies, including Titanic, Lord of the Rings. And he's written three books, including the latest one, Intersect. A former NASA astronomer breaks his silence about UFOs, and it's a heck of a read. Marion, glad to have you here.
Nice to be here. You know, I was just in the middle of wrapping gifts under the tree when you called.
Good timing. I've been in touch, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. I've sort of been following your story from afar through a third party long before the book came out, and have been really anxiously anticipating when you would be able to step forward. And I didn't know if it was going to happen or not. I mean, there were some pretty dicey events that we're going to cover here soon. But I guess to start it off with, you're rolling the dice. You're kind of you're hoping that by coming forward that you're some of the stuff that's been happening to you will stop, right?
I was. As a matter of fact, as my brother and some of my friends will attest, I almost didn't make it here, though I didn't want to worry you about that, because 2 days ago, one of these people drove by. I was in a parking lot of a Vons here locally shopping, and I was just putting things in my trunk of my car, and a generic silver car pulled up and said, hey, what year is your car? And so I was just ignoring them because I drive a classic car. So I get, chatted up by people, about classic cars all the time. So I just sort of putting things in my trunk. Like, oh, yeah, she's a 67, Pontiac. Like, oh, nice car. Like, oh, thanks. And then the person all of a sudden it was just this chill. Gosh, it would be a shame if anything happened to you or your car. That would be really a shame. I hope you're both okay. And then the person drove off. So it was felt like a warning shot across the bow. That was just really, really creepy.
Well, we're going to find out why you got into this kind of a pickle, and what we're going to take our time doing it. You start your book, Intersect, with sort of a warning to the readers. Yes, this is going to be about UFOs, and yes, most scientists scoff at the subject. They dismiss it with a wave of their hand. You were one of those guys, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I was. we used to hang out, at the various facilities over at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and mock Richard Hoagland and Face on Mars and all that, and the whole UFO crowd and all of that. It was very, very much so. And during the JPL open houses, people would show up sometimes that asked questions, and we were extremely dismissive of all of that.
You know, the whole idea about skepticism, it's very necessary in a field like this, as crazy as it gets, honest skepticism. But it seems like for the scientists you describe who would dismiss it without really knowing a lot about it, it's kind of the opposite of what skepticism should be or what science should be, right?
I agree, yeah. There's a difference between dismissing something and actually being investigative. So when you're confronted with something unknown, you should take a look at it and investigate it, not just, offhand. Oh, that's, like I may point out in my book, they're willing to throw every excuse under the sun, no matter how ludicrous it is, instead of simply looking at something for what it might be and trying to investigate it that way.
It seems like science makes advances when it makes errors, and you know, you got to keep trying and plugging away, and you cross something off the list. You investigate the unexplained, not explain the uninvestigated. That's the way progress is made.
Yeah, I love to like tell people even nowadays, like things like the city of Troy, for example, that was considered myth until an amateur archaeologist, you know, decided, no, I'm going to follow the literary clues and actually find it, and then boom, now it's fine. And of course, every archaeologist in the world, oh, of course, I knew that. You know,
yeah, and the example of meteorites.
We're dismissive.
Yeah, the example of meteorites. That's one in the literature where
exactly.
So there's a section in your book where you share some of the lines you would use. You'd give these tours to people, public groups that would come to JPL on occasion, and what you would say to these groups, you'd tell them, you know, there's nothing to this. Aliens are not dissecting cows. They're not making crop circles or abducting
right.
kids. Right. I found that it was highly entertaining because I'm sure that was the prevailing view among your colleagues there and probably still is.
Yeah, it is. Though some of them have shared privately that they are of the same mindset, even if they haven't seen necessarily anything. And some of them, surprisingly, actually have seen some things, but they are terrified to have their careers just absolutely destroyed. So they said that they'll happily support me privately, but they will completely out me publicly.
Thanks. Those are good friends.
Thanks a lot.
I found, you know, we're going to get to in a moment to the big events and what it meant for you. But I found the preview material pretty interesting, too. You had an encounter there at JPL with a character from the world of ufology and cryptozoology named Eric Beckyard. And I remember him from, I guess, 1989, 90. Yeah, after I started writing stories on the air about UFOs and related mysteries, he attached himself to me, not quite as he did to you and JPL, but I'd get letters all the time and run into him at conferences. And, you know, he was an interesting character, but incredibly overbearing. And please share with us the story about how Eric came to JPL and really didn't exactly leave a good impression of all of us saucer people with the scientists there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that, you know, how time softens things just in general, because now when I talk about this story with people, some of my friends who lived it with me, they're like, my God, you almost sound, you have to talk about the story with a degree of affection. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like after a while, you just feel sorry for the person and this and that. He died in obscurity and all that. And, but yeah, the event itself, oh my gosh, I almost lost my job and my career because of him, because he showed up. I didn't know who he was. I don't know how he got access, but the facility that I was running at the time when he was there, the Planetary Image Facility, was a public facility which still had restricted access. You had to get clearance in order to be able to go there. And it archived all of the imagery for all of NASA. And this is for the unmanned mission specifically, and mainly. And then, of course, there's a whole thing about a story about some manned information that got there, which is another side strange story, which you can read in the book called The Gemini Affair. That was really bizarre. But anyway, Eric Beckyard made his way in, and he was like just a bulldozer. He's absolutely, like you said, overbearing. He's this, you know, large, powerful man. And he, you know, he's just taking pictures of everything, wanted to see everything. I gave him free Viking orbiter maps and things like that to try and placate him and pacify him, make him happy, and try to do everything I could. But he was there for a number of weeks and just terrified all the other researchers. My facility became basically barren as everybody just, all the scientists just scattered off into the corners and everything because he just terrified everybody so much. And then ultimately it all came to a head when he found the seven dwarfs on images of the Snow White and the seven dwarfs in some craters, and also some Arthurian, a Guinevere or something like that, in another crater. It was just, you know, like really crazy, crazy stuff. So I finally said, I go, that's all fine. I go, you found these things. And he's snapping pictures with his 35-millimeter camera, for those of you who remember that kind of stuff. I told him, well, look, it's the end of the day. It's a Friday. You're welcome to come back Monday and continue with your sort of quote-unquote research. But I've got a life to live. I got a weekend and everything coming up, and we got to close shop. and he refused to leave. He said, no, if he left, that I would psychically manipulate the pictures so that the things he had found would be gone. And I got to the point that when you read the story, I go into all the details, but basically I had to have security come and had to have him removed. And he didn't take that lying down at all. Instead, he got in his car, drove cross country, and he, I guess, had some sort of a military background, a connection to people, I don't know, in the government in D.C. And he finagled his way in to some senators who actually convened a Senate panel to investigate me.
And for being mean to him.
That I was restricting access to public information. And this came down like a ton of bricks at JPL. My line management, when you're at JPL, a facility like JPL, you have several lines of types of management. You have line management, which are the administrators, and you have scientific managers, which are your science people, et cetera, et cetera. And so the line management was just who were in charge of things like HR and stuff. We're like, we're cutting you loose. We are not going to go up against the Senate. We don't know what this is all about, but you're out of here. And I had to pull all sorts of strings from NASA headquarters and everything, from people that I knew and stuff, in order to stop that from happening. But it was absolutely a nightmare. And to me, it was just like, okay, so this is the UFO community. This is what they do to scientists. I just really dug my heels in at that point.
Right. He was a handful for sure. But I appreciate people with passion like that. And he certainly was.
I do too.
Yeah. And then you have another, and we won't get into details on this, but you had another experience there where UFO people showed up and jumped up on the tables and staged the demonstration. They, like Eric, suspected that JPL and NASA were hiding stuff, were altering images, accusing the organization of a cover-up. And you know, that was it was a problem at the time, but you didn't believe it. Then you find evidence of a cover-up of sorts. There's a secret stash of films and images within JPL. Tell us that part of the story.
Yeah, I felt bad for those people, because those people left literally almost in tears. They believed in alien lunar bases and lunar cities, and it turned out to not be so. And I was able to show them that, but this was a really, really strange thing, and I go into detail about this. Under the floorboards, sometimes you just have to sort of get your hands dirty at a job. And in this case, I knew that I had to pull some cables and things like that, and we had a suspended floor that had ducting underneath it. So while pulling up the carpeting and some cables, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to route these. By the time I put in a NASA request for the people to come in, the facilities people to come in, it's going to take like weeks or a month, and I need this video connections to be up now. So I just figured I'd pull it myself. When I opened up the panels, part of the way in, as I started crawling in, I found a stash of canisters, of silver metal canisters, and I thought, what is this? And, you know, film canisters. I pulled them out, you know, one by one, stacked them up, and I looked at the labels, and I know enough about historical imagery to recognize the code numbers on them, that these are not just duplicate films. These are original films. They were Gemini astronaut shot films, that they had handheld films that they had taken. And so I was like, wow, this is incredible. So I was just excited that, like, I'm touching history. You know, these are Gemini things. And my focus in the facility was that we had some like Apollo and Gemini things and a little touch of Mercury. Most of it was for unmanned missions. So this kind of stuff had no business being there, especially under the floor. So I called some friends and said, hey, guess what I found and everything. I have to turn this stuff over and find out how to route it to the right place, but check it out. One of my friends was like, no, don't call anybody yet. You've got to come down there and everything. We'll explain when we get there. I'm like, okay. And this is what I was saying earlier when we were talking about how there are people at JPL, outliers, who won't admit that they believe in UFOs or things like that, or extraterrestrials, but they're there. So this is one of those people. And he raced down, and this person was just like, well, you got to unroll the film. I have a list here for you. And I'm like, a film frame. So I'm like, oh, okay, what are you looking for? He's all, these film frames and everything supposedly have UFOs in them. I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? I go, you're stopping me for this? So I'm like, okay, fine. I go, and then it turns out like a whole gathering of almost a dozen people showed up of all my friends, because word spread fast. This stuff was, you know, there was a really rare opportunity to look at real, like the originals. So it was all white glove time. So we unrolled it. We went through
I tell you what, Marian, hold on a second. Sorry to stop you at that point of the story, but this gets really good. And I think in the end, this is what puts you kind of on the map for these men in black people that we'll be talking about next. So we'll continue our conversation with Marian Rudnick, author of Intersect. And our conversation with Marian Rudnick, his new book is called Intersect, and it tells this interesting story of an amazing encounter that he has and then the subsequent fallout in his life. And the story we're about to hear is maybe where it started for him, what put him on the radar screens of higher-ups and shadowy agents. He's working at JPL, dealing with this vast archive of photos and videos and films from the NASA missions, and he finds under the floorboards this gigantic stash of film canisters from the Gemini missions. Now, if you're a student of ufology, you know that the story has always been around, this legend that Gemini astronauts saw and filmed UFOs during some of those missions. And the images that have been put out by NASA don't show any of those images. So what was in this giant stash? When we come back, we're going to find out. And we're going to find out what happened to Marian as a result of finding them. We'll be right back. Marian, to pick up the story, you were unaware of the significance of the Gemini original films. You weren't familiar with the stories that have been told about what those astronauts had seen until your colleague come hovering around wanting to see what you've got, right?
That's correct.
So continue the conversation. What'd you find?
Yeah, so, well, what we found was nothing. We found that actually that, but that's a relative statement in the sense that we found that the frames that they were looking for had been cut out of the film. They were missing frames, and they were just like, you know, they were all beside themselves over this. For me, it was a little bit of a wake-up call, and I really didn't know what to think of it. But in the typical sense, I'm like, well, there must have been a reason they were moved. You know, maybe this or that. You know, and my friends are like, no, are you kidding and everything? The exact frames that people say have UFOs are the exact ones that are missing. There's a reason. I'm like, well, I go, that may be. I go, but I have to turn the films over. So then that started a whole different kind of a weirdness, because as I tried to call Johnson Space Center in Houston and talk to somebody about this, I started getting the runaround from people who didn't believe me. And then finally, well, the last person I talked to, they're really, really nasty and dismissive. And I said, look, we're all on the same team here and everything. I don't know what you expect, think that I'm pulling. But I have Gemini films, and they're original. I go, and why don't you leave the following code number for your higher-ups? You know, pass this on, and we'll see what you think. So I read them off the number off of one of the canisters, and the end of the number was a key. I don't remember exactly what it was, but there's a code that was used that identified the film as being an original. And lo and behold, minutes later, I get a angry phone call and everything about, you know, how I had this film, how did I manage to find it, and I go, and so I explain, and they said, don't open it, don't look at it, you're not to do anything with it, and I'm like, okay, and they said, we will send a courier over right away to pick it up first thing in the morning. You're going to be there before opening hours, and someone will be there, and that's exactly what happened. This person in a dark gray suit, and security wasn't even able to identify. I asked them, who is this person? I go, somebody at my door. Why didn't you call me? And they said, you know, we are not supposed to call you. They're just there. Just hand them the film. I go, where's the paperwork? I have something signed, you know, that I'm transferring, you know, ownership of this. These are original films. And this person was just very dry, very, very strict, and said, you're to give me the films and shut up, and, you know, and that's all there is to it. You know, you're done with this. And they took the films, and that was it. And I did what I was told to do, and they walked off with the films and never saw them again.
It's, you know, we could do the whole show on just this, who might have stashed them under the floorboards or why they were put there. But the significance of it to me is that these were the originals that had been edited. Those images had been spliced, had been cut out, and then another copy is made for the public that doesn't, you can't tell it's been edited.
Exactly.
Something was in there they didn't want to put out.
Yeah. I agree. Very, very much so.
Do you think that looking back now, that is what put you on the radar screen of these guys that we're going to talk about coming up?
Yeah, it was kind of a watershed moment because it was also sort of a kind of a slap in the face for me because it was like all of a sudden it was a kind of a crack in the chink of the armor of seeing that these things are real because this would have been like a conspiracy person's dream. Oh, the films are hidden somewhere under a floor, blah, blah, blah. You know, people like, yeah, right. You know, the original NASA's got the original films and the public sees them. No, they didn't. And I have to this day, I have no explanation why it would be under the floorboards of a building that it used to be actually a computer facility. But that building dates all the way back to the 50s. So, I don't know how it got there. It's just obviously it was put there, and somebody knew. Obviously, the inference was when the person who came by to pick it up is that they seemed to not be surprised that it was there, but they seemed to be shocked that I found it.
So you make a transition at some point. You leave NASA. You love that work. I mean, you discovered a bunch of asteroids. You named one for your mom, as I remember from the book. So it was very exciting, but you wanted other challenges. You're living in Southern California. You get involved in the movie business, which opens up all kinds of cool doors, and you work on tremendous films. And then you have this incident that is the main focus of the book, Intersect. Tell us the story, what you saw, what you photographed, and then we'll take it from there.
There is one incident that I'll touch on that was in the book. Even in Hollywood, it's funny because I wound up doing some consulting stuff, science consulting, in the middle of all of that work. And there was one incident that I detail in the book where I was actually asked to paint out a UFO at one of the studios, and that was, you know, also. But I just did it because I just figured, yeah, you know, there's. It can't be real. I was just very dismissive of it. But yeah, when as far as the main event goes, it was a very innocent kind of a thing. It was just like right now, you know, New Year's is coming up, and New Year's Eve was cold and rainy, much kind of like the weather we have right now over here in Southern California at this time, as a matter of fact. It's kind of ironic. And New Year's Day was January 1st was a Sunday. And this is important because this all happens at a McDonald's McDiner, and I don't think there's any McDiners around except for this last one now. They're like 50s diner style McDonald's, and it's here in Monrovia. And what happened was because it's on a New Year's is on a Sunday here, at least for California, when New Year's Day falls on a Sunday, then things like the Rose Parade and the Rose Bowl game and all the big celebratory events that happen New Year's Day get bumped January 2nd. And this is key as far as what happened with me because New Year's Day was actually just dead. It was cold, rainy. New Year's Eve had happened before. No one was on the streets. It was very, very quiet. So I told my mom, you know what? We like this McDiner and everything. They have retro music and all that. You know, I had gotten a Christmas present, a digital camera. I go, you know what? Let's go to the diner. I can take some pictures of my car in front of the diner. There's probably will be nobody there, so I can take pictures of the car by itself in front of the diner, which would be kind of cool. And then we'll just hang out over there just to get out of the house and stuff, and we can watch the rain through the diner windows. And so that's what we did exactly. And in the book, I included all those pictures just to show just how empty it was. We were the only ones in the diner, except for the employees who were shocked to see us. And as we were sitting there eating, something caught my eye. Something was dropping out of the clouds. And at first, I just told my mom. I thought, well, I probably just something, you know, aircraft for the parade or something like that. It's probably no big deal. And then I thought, wait a minute. There's nothing flying right now. It's dead today. Everything's tomorrow. There shouldn't be anything in the sky right now. So I told him, you know what? I'm gonna go outside and take a look, you know, what I'm seeing in the clouds. So I went outside real quick and everything and looked up, and I saw just dropping out of the clouds, becoming more and more visible than they were before, four discs. And they had very distinctive triangular panels on the underside, and one of them appeared to be in trouble. And the only way I could describe why is I could see that there were splotches, dark splotches on the other side. So either it maybe had been hit by lightning or somehow damaged or whatever, and it was behaving in a way. The best way I can describe it is like, you know, when you have a herd of animals and one is injured and you can tell which one is injured because by its behavior, this was this way. The disc dropped down in a diamond formation, and the formation started breaking up really rapidly. And that disc was struggling, and it was sinking down. And after a very short while, I'm like, what am I doing here? I've got my digital camera with me. I could take some pictures. So I took the camera out, and as they approached, the discs moved across from south towards north, towards the mountains. There was a gust. The rain had stopped, but there were gusty winds that were going from west to east. And these things were flying across that. And silent, no sound, no nothing, silently. But they were dropping down lower and lower. So I snapped a picture, and the camera's really, really slow. It's like you could do a 10-second count almost. So I thought, okay, you know what? They're going to approach its closest point. I'm going to try and do a video. So I flipped it to video mode. And as I shot about 34 seconds of video, but it was really problematic because as I was trying to shoot the video, you know how the digital cameras have these autofocus squares? Multiple autofocus squares just appeared all over on my screen and started dancing all over the screen. So I couldn't see what I'm filming on the thing. I had to assume that since I had a lamppost that they were passing that was in the foreground, that they had to be in frame. I tried to zoom in, tried to zoom out, but the focus frames were dancing around. I'd never seen the camera do that ever before, and I don't know why. And so then I finally flipped that off of the video mode and went back into picture mode. And then I shot three more pictures. And of those three pictures, one of them actually turned out to be, thankfully, the most clear. And after the last picture, the fourth picture that I shot, the objects were beginning to slowly climb, and they were reestablishing their formation. It seemed like it was almost as if there was an unseen force helping the crippled craft right itself and be able to join the formation. So I thought, oh my God, they're going to be gone soon and everything. I got to get somebody. So I looked back through the windows of the diner to see if there's an employee that I could grab. I couldn't grab my mom because she was almost 80 years old at that point. She wasn't going to make it in time. I thought, grab an employee to come out real quick to see this with me. And then I turned back real quick and everything to spot where the UFOs were, how they're progressing. They're gone. They were just in a flash. They had just gone. But they had been heading towards the mountains. And so that's basically the incident itself. And then when I came back to the table, I explained to my mom what had happened, and we poured through the camera and everything looking at the frames. But, you know, it's a tiny little screen. It's hard to tell and everything. And it's so funny. You see it. You know, this is the thing that's almost ridiculously ludicrous. Here I am, a scientist, and I see it with my own eyes that these are flying, and I still have to take the camera back and upload the pictures to my laptop to see them close up to make sure that the picture caught what I saw in order to believe that I saw what I saw. but that's exactly what I did. When we got home, I uploaded the pictures and was able to zoom in, and in one of the frames you could clearly see the disc. You could clearly see the triangular panels that I saw. You could even hear in the video. The video was very disappointing, unfortunately, because they were like fuzzy dots. Obviously, the focus frame dancing problem, which I don't know why that was happening, had caused the object to appear to pulsate in the video and to be out of focus and do strange things in the video. But they're there and they're moving, and so it establishes that, which is really nice. But one frame in particular, you could really, really make out the details that I saw, and that was amazing.
So tell me this: how they were moving. You said, you know, you looked up and they're gone. You didn't see them leave, but they were just, you could, you know, had at one point you no longer could see them anywhere.
Right. It was just literally, imagine yourself if you turn around for a second to look at something and then turn back around, and the thing is just gone. But they still had quite a ways to go to reach the clouds, or the mountains, but there's simply nothing there anymore at all. They must have just punched it and just taken off.
And the formation itself, while they were up there and in your eyesight, or you had a look at them, were they, did they change how they, their relationship to each other, or did they all stay sort of the same distance from each other in the same
No,
formation?
they changed, they shifted. It was almost as if the other three were moving in a way to try and help the fourth one come back into the formation, as if they were trying to, like, no, you're not, because it would have gone down. That craft was sinking. But somehow all of a sudden they managed to pull it up, and they started reestablish their diamond formation, and that was the formation that just before they left. So for some reason it was important for them to fly together that way.
You suspect, or one idea you had was that one was ready to crash. These other ones came to its aid.
Yes, and that's exactly, I think, why I think this would have just been just another UFO sighting, quote unquote, if it had just been, words, and everything and hearsay, and if there or if there was just video but no pictures, or pictures and no video. But having both pictures and a video, and me being an astronomer, all of a sudden, it became a big deal, and that's why Space Command took such an interest. And Space Command finding out, though I know some people thought that I outed my own sighting, I did not. It was just by accident. I shared the information with a friend, and that friend happened to have somebody highly placed in Space Command in their family. All the million to one odds.
I
And
tell you what,
that.
I want to spend some time on that part of the story, because that really is what leads to all the troubles that we're going to get into after the top of the hour. Staying with the photos for a minute, I mean, the fact that you are an astronomer, you're a trained observer, and you are also an experienced photographer, all that combined to you getting some really terrific images. I'm looking at what you did. You organized them. I mean, that was your job at JPL. One of the jobs is, dealing with archive photos and videos and film. So you were experienced in that. And what you've done in putting it into this book is terrific. That image 1680, you break it down four images for each of the objects and show different views of them. It's terrific. And that 1680 is the one I'm referencing. That's a really good one. That's a good photo.
1680 is spectacular, and what people don't realize, what I should do is I should post a video like of me filming my screen. It's spectacular because when you look at the actual image and you zoom in on it and whatever, it's the field of depth came out to be so good that you actually it looks like you can see a tiny disc, and then when you zoom, all of a sudden all this detail just comes out and leaps out at you, and it becomes just incredibly real. I'm still really, really hyper fixated on that image. And just on the craft themselves, there's something about them that just draws me to them now.
The reason I ask about how they moved in relation to each other is because I saw online where some people were discussing your book, the debunkers took aim at you and said, these are just things that are hanging down from a blimp that is obscured by the by clouds, which is
Oh my God, that is they'll invent anything they can. There are no blimps in the air, and you would have seen the blimp. They are far below the cloud deck and everything. You would have what, 1,000-foot tethers and everything on what?
Yeah.
And then of course they would have been bouncing around because there was gusty winds. And in the pictures you can see, as a matter of fact, this is the beauty of the fact that I took pictures of the car. There's a flag, and I put this in the book. There's a giant, giant flag across the street, just absolutely massive. And the gusty winds were strong enough that that big flag was moving, and moving a lot. And then you can also hear the video. You hear this clang, 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 which is the McDonald's flag, the tether that holds the flag, banging against the pole, because the winds were so strong and gusty. And
Yeah,
yet that thing
and these
moved
things weren't
really
affected at
smooth.
all, right? These things weren't affected by the headwinds at all. All right, when we come back, we'll get into the story about the aftermath and how your life kind of changes forever because of the people who found out that you had taken these photos. We're talking with Marian Rudnick about his book, Intersect: A Former NASA Astronomer Breaks His Silence About UFOs and Things Go Downhill.